disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give
in. Don't you give up, don't you dare give in. Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell, the women's rights in the workplace activists and advocates, thrilled to be here with you on this Monday evening to talk about workplace issues that matter most to you and the people that you love. How are you, Deborah O'Rell?
I'm fantastic.
We are thrilled today to have with us a special guest to talk about what the show is basically going to be about, something that's probably close to everybody's heart, the notion of the dissatisfaction that you feel about your work experience. And I bet you do. Most people do. And of course, it gets to the point at some exacerbated peak level where it is called burnout. And it happens more frequently these days than probably at any time in modern society in our, you know, more recent past. So we have with us, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it, I just want to introduce Joy Murphy. Hi, Joy.
Hi, Jack.
Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Joy Murphy is a leadership coach. She is a certified coach, communications consultant, an executive coach and life coach specializing in leadership development and personal growth. Joy works with compassion, humor, accountability, and courage, challenging her clients to stretch past old habits and belief systems to create a powerful vision for the future and to bring authentic leadership into their lives, relationships, and their business. With more than 15 years' experience in brand messaging and communications strategy for the fashion and retail industries, Joy's coaching expertise includes supporting clients in finding their authentic voice, developing a polished personal professional brand, strengthening communication presentation skills, acquiring effective management styles, and putting structured action around achieving goals, both immediate and long term. Her broad range of clients has included entrepreneurs and executives from such diverse companies and organizations as American Express, Departures, Boston University, NBC Universal, Media Common, New York Hispanic Federation. Joy is a graduate of Coaching for Transformation and certified by the International Coaching Federation. And she is a certified Reiki Master Practitioner whose passions include yoga, meditation, spiritual exploration, and wellness. Sounds like an all-around integrative health profession. Do you actually practice Reiki on your clients that come to you for coaching, or that's a separate?
Occasionally. It's typically separate, but occasionally we do both. Okay. They're very supportive of each other, actually.
Terrific. So let me just start out with, I read an article, and it's in today's, or an op-ed piece in today's New York Times called Why You Hate Work.
Yesterday's,
thank you. And by Tony Schwartz and Christine Porath. And it starts like this, and says, the way we're working isn't working. Even if you're lucky enough to have a job, you're probably not very excited to get to the office in the morning. You don't feel much appreciated while you're there. You find it difficult to get your most important work accomplished amid all the distractions, and you don't believe that what you're doing makes much of a difference anyway. By the time you get home, you're pretty much running on empty, yet you're still answering emails until you fall asleep. Increasingly, this experience is common not just to middle managers, but also to top executives. Our company, The Energy Project, works with organizations and their leaders to improve employee engagement and more sustainable performance, like sustainable energy in the world, the idea of not running on empty, and how we can have that balance so that we can continue to kick butt and take names at work, right, and be productive. And, of course, there's probably an anomaly. What we're going to find today, I think, in our discussion is the more that you are able to sort of fill the tank and disengage, even though to employers it seems like, well, you're kind of, you're malingering or you're goofing off or this is time you could be working, the more productive you'll be when you either come back or from your break or mm-hmm. from, you know, what have you.
Right.
So that's what this, so he goes on, they go on to say, a little over a year ago, Luke Kissam, the chief executive of Albemarle, a multi-billion dollar chemical company, sought out his company as a coach to help him deal with this, with the sense that his life was increasingly overwhelming. He said, I just felt that no matter what I was doing, I was always getting pulled somewhere else. It seemed like I was always cheating someone, my company, my family, or myself. I couldn't truly focus on anything. And they go on to explain that Mr. Kissam is not alone. A psychiatrist and assistant clinical professor at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Pillay, who studies burnout, recently surveyed a random sample of 72 senior leaders and found that nearly all of them reported at least some signs of burnout, mm-hmm. and that all of them noted at least one cause of burnout at work. And more broadly, and finally, 30% of employees, just 30% of employees in America feel engaged, only one-third of us.
I would say that differently. 70%
do not.
Do not.
Yeah. That's right.
And that's really the point of today's topic.
Exactly. Well, this was according to a 2013 report by Gallup. So putting it that much more meaningful way, 70% of us feel completely disengaged with our work. And across the world, around the world, across 142 countries, the proportion of employees who feel engaged at work is just 13%. So most of us, in short, to most of us, they conclude, work is a depleting, dispiriting experience, and in some ways, it's getting worse. So, you know, in my view, and we're not going to talk much about this today, but, you know, the reasons why, okay, I mean, you know, which maybe, I don't know, we don't need mm-hmm. to get perhaps as political as I might get with our guest, but, you know, we are like this because we have very few meaningful jobs in this country right now. We have exported, we've closed more than 100,000 factories in the last 13 years.
Right.
We do not invest in our infrastructure, so we keep saying we can't afford to be leaders anymore. We can't afford to be the America that we grew up in, which is just, according to the economists that we listen to, the progressives who understand reality, that's simply a canard. It's nonsense. It's a red herring. It's just what, you know, the 1% or the oligarchs say. You know what? If we actually raise the minimum wage and create more demand, which is demand that drives an economy, that's really basic econ 101, we'll have less profit, we'll have less money for the shareholders, and we might actually, you know, not have $10 billion more to stash in the Cayman Islands or in Swiss bank accounts for ourselves while we're ripping off the government. And, of course, it's simply not true. We can, there are 25 million people, according to the latest statistics I saw in this country today, pining, dying to work. We could put them to work building our country back, our infrastructure, our bridges, our dams, our rail beds. How about high-speed trains? We're falling apart. And all these people would work. All these people would create a living wage. And what do they do with that money? They spend it, which, of course, creates the economy that we have.
Middle-income people spend the hugest percentage of their money on living.
And poor people spend all of their income.
Right. And poor people, exactly, where the wealthy have money to invest and hide and stash. And
but when we had actually a fair tax structure, which wasn't as we have now, with 25% of corporations pay zero federal income taxes, and, you know, again, Mitt Romney and his ilk pay way less percentage than we do in taxes or than a surgeon does, because it's all, he can sit by his pool and wait for the dividend check. It's carried interest, so they pay 15 or 13% on it compared to our 37%.
Well, and corporations pay zero or single-digit percentages.
Exactly.
So
why?
It's not even 13% like
okay.
Mitt Romney.
So none of it is. And why is that?
And that is because the structure that we have set up right now.
37,000 lobbyists. Who are they working for?
Exactly.
37,000 lobbyists in Washington, working for the moneyed interests, and the only, and that's why, of course, the GOP.
It's the cycle.
Right.
It's how it got started. So the wealthy, the corporations will say, I'm not breaking the law. The law says this is what I can do. So therefore, the CEO is paid on shareholder value. So the CEO, what are the two areas that any company, the biggest expenses are taxes and employees. So if the CEO can cut those expenses, shareholder value goes up. He gets paid his bonuses. So he hires the lobbyists to write the laws to make sure that there is an incentive for them to keep jobs overseas or keep profits overseas mm-hmm. and not bring them back here. So he then makes his bonus. The shareholders are more willing to pay a higher price for the stock. And it starts that cycle. And that also adds to because the CEO is paid on that value, what we've been seeing over the last 15-ish years...
Well, 30-something years since Reagan's corporate counter-revolution began.
Well, just mostly in the last 15, maybe 20 years, is CEO revolving door. Because after they've hired the lobbyists, got the laws, in order to keep maintaining those bonuses... they've got to keep improving the profits like that. And that's why they keep corporations are now churning through CEOs
right,
so that the next
right.
one can come in and make the money.
Right.
And,
and
the politicians are paid by the corporations, so therefore they're not willing to change the laws. And this is whether it's Republican or Democrat. Nobody is stepping up. There are very few mm-hmm. politicians willing to change the system, which is get money out of politics.
Right. Amend the Constitution. Money is not speech.
There you go.
Okay. And corporations aren't persons. Women are yet not persons. We haven't passed the Equal Rights Amendment yet since 1922,
exactly.
but corporations are now persons.
That was another show.
Another show. Okay. So without belaboring it, my whole point was, because we're going to engage Joy to talk about the practical aspects of this, I want to talk about what it really means. You still, when you have burnout, you have burnout, regardless of your politics right now, and it's important. And we all have to stay focused on the present and how we can be the best we can be with the resources we have under the circumstances that we all live, even while we're trying to still educate each other. And one of the things I did want to say about that, and I think you heard this in a great interview with the economist, the progressive economist Joseph Stiglitz on the Bill Moyer show recently, and everybody mm-hmm. can find that on YouTube. And I recommend to everybody to immediately go out and buy Tom Hartman's The Crash of 2016, because he lays it out brilliantly how we're heading to another Great Depression on or about, you know, yes. in the year of 2016, and the reasons why and what we could do to change it. And it's really not, it's something you don't hear on the corporate media. You hear it on PRN.FM, and you hear it on the very, you know, sort of the scant by comparison to the right wing talk radio, liberal progressive radio and television, but it really doesn't get through, you know, with the behemoths like Fox News sprouting all, you know, the lies basically, the Fox so-called news, that gets everyone to vote against their interest, you know, the middle class and the lower classes, etc. We could be creating all these jobs. Why? Because we make the money,
right.
And that's what we did after World War II. We had far greater, you know, debt to GDP ratio. We spent our way to prosperity by creating all of those programs that even Eisenhower.
And what was the top tax rate?
Like 91%.
Exactly.
And you know what happens when the tax rates are what they are now? Virtually nothing. What it creates is wealthy people, the very wealthy, have an incentive to pull it out, take it as profit, pay no taxes, or hide it in the tax havens. In the old day, when it was 91%, on of course, incomes above a certain point. If you make over, let's say, $3 million a year, you were taxed at that high rate. You kept it in the business, so you didn't have to get it,
right.
And then you created, that was more jobs.
But in all fairness, the economy in the world has changed. It is more of a global market, so the idea of going back to 75-90% tax rates isn't going to happen.
Well, it's a global. Well, it should happen, and it'll happen if Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren are ever in office. And it only
I don't know that 90% is.
Maybe not 90%. Let's go back up to Clinton's 35%
exactly.
when we had a surplus.
Well, and the whole reason that we're losing all of this is because all of these corporations do not. On a moral, because this is the whole Wall Street thing. The greed has taken over.
Well, of
course. And that corporations are not giving back.
But that's because they're not regulated. They're like dogs. They're like, they need to be regulated.
Well, no, it's not even regulated because they just keep paying the lobbyists to change the law.
Well,
that's the point.
Right. So fundamentally,
so
take money out of politics.
And there are companies
right.
that do this successfully, like Costco, et cetera.
Okay. Well, okay. By the way, the only reason I think we're talking about a global market is because of the so-called free trade nonsense, which is used to be called like protectionism. We should be. Why is it that if you'll go to buy a pair of sneakers to pick, you know, something that you might do, it's very difficult to find one made in the USA anymore.
Yeah.
And so the idea that we now, you know, we used to be the largest exporter of goods, and now we're the largest importer. So it's a huge deficit, and China owns us. And all of that was, again, for the top for the top folks in the corporations to churn and burn through with no responsibility to this country and to its innards, you know, and to allow the rest of us.
Did you see that research on the poll or the survey that was just done about the 1% and what the 1% and this, oh God, I'm going to pull it up. Keep talking. I'm going to pull this up. This was the questions that were asked of people, of the 99% and the 1%, you know, in terms of responsibility, giving back. Do you believe that as a society we should help those who are in need? 1% says no.
Right, right. Well, they are comprised, unfortunately. There's a number of sociopaths that make it up, and that's just part of it. But I'm saying, I mean, this is sort of statistically, you know, proven. Okay.
Really?
Yes, there are. Well, first of all, and I've seen this about CEOs, to be in that position and to be Steve Helmsley and pull down $100 million a year while kicking kids off of, he's the CEO of United Healthcare, it requires a certain mentality that is often, and I can't cite to the study now, but there are a certain disproportionate level of sociopaths at those levels. And the financialization just of our world that, you know, in the wake of all these, the lack of regulation and the several, you know, the laws that have now, that did a great job at keeping commercial banks to be boring where people kept their money.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Now, that we everything now is, you know, people who, I haven't given the statistic yet today, 42 men in New York in 2011, last time I saw the statistics, that are hedge fund managers, 42 men that manage hedge funds averaged take-home pay, $2 billion each. One, John Paulson, $4 billion, some of the others, $1.something billion, $2 billion. And people go, oh, $2 billion, that's a lot of money. You know how much $2 billion is? An hour? $2 billion a year for a 40-hour week is $969,000 an hour. I mean, it's just, it's of course obscene. And of course, they don't really, what are they earning? They're really just skimming it off. I mean, this is all.
Well, that's what Stiglitz was saying, too.
Bubbles, they're bubbles.
Yeah.
Okay.
We didn't produce a single thing. All we did was create a law to manufacture on paper money.
But this state of affairs has us all a little bit buggy, okay? Because most of us realize now, we see it in our practice, this is not a fertile environment for most of us are not sanguine about if you lose your job, there'll be many others. You know, we see people every day that just go, if I lose my job, I'm 42 years old, and
I'm
a single mother, or I'm 59 years old, who's going to hire me? You know, I've been here 16 years, I make good money, am I working in ShopRite? And how am I supposed to get by? There's a lot of fear, and a lot of it is sort of authentic and understandable because we also really don't have much of a safety net. So you can run out of money, you cannot have health care, you could be in bankruptcy. We're the only civilized nation that doesn't consider health care to be a right of citizenship. We really are sort of a tough, cold place out there. And because of that, what do we do and how do we navigate when we're miserable at work, when our employers say, you know what, I don't really give a shit about you because 10 people are waiting for your job. So I say jump, you say how high. And you know what, I'm not your therapist. I don't really give a shit about you getting an exercise during the day or meditating. That's it. You're here to...
For your kids.
You don't really give a shit about it. You know what, you don't listen.
International
right.
day
You can't school. Stand the heat, sister. Get out of the kitchen. That's it. And go back to your other kitchen. So in this environment, we have more and more people that are, I am sure, and only, you know, we see a certain level of it, but people who work and money and issues in that realm create a lot of internal stress and suffering and misery and pain and anxiety. So that work issue where people can no longer, you know, there was a song we probably were all old enough to remember, I think in the 70s, called Take This Job and Shove It, that was like number one. It was number one because it hit a chord back then where people was like, take this job and shove it, I'll go somewhere else. Nobody's saying that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to talk a little bit before we ask Joy Murphy about this. Job burnout. They mentioned that in this article. People know the term. I'm burnt out, burnout. Sometimes it's used sort of colloquially. I'm burnt out. I just can't think anymore. Well, you know what? The Mayo Clinic has a medical definition for burnout. And I'm just going to read right from their website. Job burnout, how to spot it and take action. Job burnout is a special type of job stress. It's a state of physical, emotional, or mental exhaustion combined with doubts about your competence and the value of your work. If you think you might be experiencing job burnout, take a closer look at the phenomenon. What you learn may help you face the problem and take action before job burnout affects your health. Could you be experiencing job burnout? Ask yourself the following questions. Have you become cynical or critical at work? Hello? Okay, that's probably a big one for most of us. Do you drag yourself to work and have trouble getting started once you arrive? Have you become irritable or impatient with coworkers, customers, or clients? Do you lack the energy to be consistently productive? Do you lack satisfaction from your achievements? Do you feel disillusioned about your job? Are you using food, drugs, or alcohol to feel better or to simply not feel? Have your sleep habits or appetite changed? Are you troubled by unexplained headaches, backaches, or other physical complaints? If you answered yes to any one of these questions, you may be experiencing job burnout, let alone all of them. Be sure to consult your doctor or a mental health provider, however. Some of these symptoms can also indicate health conditions such as thyroid disorder or depression. What causes job burnout? It can result from various factors, including lack of control and inability to influence decisions that affect your job, such as your schedule, assignments, or workload, and can lead to job burnout. So could a lack of the resources you need to do your work. And again, in the same economy that we were just talking about, inability to influence decisions about your job, your schedule, or assignments is sort of endemic to this new world order, because you're not going to have control over that when you work for the man, if you will, or you're just another cog in that machine, and you are dispensable. Unclear job expectations. If you're unclear about the degree of authority you have or what your supervisor or others expect from you, you're not likely to feel comfortable at work. Third, dysfunctional workplace dynamics. Well, I'm always saying, at least the people we see, every workplace seems to be one big dysfunctional family away from their other dysfunctional family. But here, perhaps it's saying perhaps you work with an office bully. You feel undermined by colleagues, or your boss micromanages your work. I thought that's what they were supposed to do. These and related situations can contribute to job stress. Fourth, mismatch in values. If your values differ from the way your employer does business or handles grievances, the mismatch may eventually take a toll on you. Fifth, poor job fit. If your job doesn't fit your interests and skills, it may become increasingly stressful over time. Sixth, extremes of activity. When a job is always monotonous or chaotic, you need constant energy to remain focused, which can lead to fatigue and job burnout. Lack of social support. Seven, if you feel isolated at work and in your personal life, you may feel more stressed. And finally, work-life imbalance. If your work takes up so much of your time and effort that you don't have the energy to spend time with your family and friends, you may burn out quickly. So most of these things, while they read sort of like these are, you know, the symptoms of this disorder, in fact, they probably affects most of us at some point in our jobs, at some point in our lives, if not at some point in every week of our lives if we don't manage it well. So, Joy, if someone calls you to consult with you and they're experiencing something akin to that, so again, just tell us, when someone calls and it's just like, okay, I'm calling you because I don't know whether to, you know, shit or go blind. Like, I don't know what to do. I'm screwed. I don't know. I have a terrible job. My life is sort of, I'm, you know, I hate my job. I hate my boss.
Right.
What do I do?
But I'm a single mother. I have to, you know, pay the rent.
A single mother, schmother. I live in Manhattan. I live in Queens. I have to pay $2,300 a month rent. This is no way to. People say, well, just tell them to get off. And then what? You know, homelessness? So how do you balance that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm really happy to be here and be talking about this, so thank you again for having me. And I want to say that I really appreciated the article that you referenced at the beginning. I'm a big fan of Tony Schwartz and of the Energy Project and the work that they're doing. I do want to mention, you know, you talked a lot about the challenges for corporations, the CEOs that are watching the bottom line because they're watching what's going into their bank account and their bonuses and protecting themselves. And I do want to say there is some good news. So let me just comment on the little bit of the good news first, which is that, you know, there are many corporations, certainly forward-thinking corporations that you would expect, like a Google, who are building mindfulness practices, meditation practices, even into their corporate culture.
Right.
But there are also some companies that you wouldn't expect, the more the traditional companies, the McKinsey's, the Deutsch's, that are also starting to build these practices into, build wellness into their corporate culture. And so I think we are headed, you know, not entirely, and we've got a long way to go, but there are some models that are forging ahead and paving a way for all of us to really watch. And they're seeing the results. You know, when our needs are met at work, we function better, we are more productive, and therefore our companies are more profitable. And there is scientific, you know, evidence to prove this. Mm-hmm. You know, research shows that when we are happy at work, sales increase by 37%, productivity goes up by 31%. So when we're talking with companies about building wellness and mindfulness into their culture, we're not talking about abandoning profitability or that drive to, you know, make the dollar and improve the sales. We're actually talking about some non-traditional ways to improve productivity and success across the entire corporation. Your workforce is your most valuable asset. So let's help them to strive and to thrive, and the company will as a result. So there are some models that are doing that that I think are important to know.
And so, all right, the companies that you mentioned, how large, can you just mention those two companies that you mentioned that are still doing it? What'd you say?
Well, Google,
Nike,
Deutsche Bank, Huffington Post. Arianna Huffington is a huge advocate for wellness and mindfulness.
Okay, so Huffington Post has a facility somewhere where everybody
works? They have sleep rooms. Mm-hmm. They have meditation. Okay. Oprah has brought meditation into, you know, OWN, so that a bell goes off twice a day. I mean, there are companies.
Okay, but let me push back in this and play a little devil's advocate. Oprah, Google, we know. I mean, these are outliers.
Huffington Post is a global company.
Okay, and Deutsche, are we talking about a German bank?
Yeah.
So Deutsche Bank here in the United States, can you just talk a little bit about what they do?
I'm not an authority on what they do, but I do know that they were referenced as part of the research as a company that is building this into, as is McKinsey. So, you know, there are companies that even you wouldn't expect to be sort of open-minded
like
in terms of things that are touchy-feely, in terms of things that are getting you away from the numbers. But they really are, and they're seeing the results in the numbers.
So, but presumably these companies also probably pay a living wage and have health benefits that are affordable and and otherwise consider their employees to be a human, an actual really important human resource that they are. I mean, obviously you don't see this in Walmart and the big banks, because we, you know, most of the people who call our office, and again, if we look at a cross-section, I could probably say this is not science, but 90, well into like 95% plus of the people who call and say I'm having problems, and we deal with many different kinds of employers, not that we know everything about all of their policies, but most of them don't have any of these. There's not only is there no meditation room, you often can't take lunch during the busy season.
Sure.
They don't have paid maternity leave. None of them have. I don't know whether that – Google probably has. Arianna Huffington probably has some – you know, probably it's probably gender neutral too. It's probably paternity leave. But the vast majority still don't. So if being – are you – advising the companies often or individuals or both?
I work with both. I mean, I certainly work with a lot of individuals that come to me saying I'm feeling the burnout, right?
Okay.
That you referenced before. I'm just in a rut. I can't find a solution. I can't find my way out, or I just need to change. And I'm unhappy at work, and it's affecting every other area of my life.
So take us through what you would do with this person.
So first and foremost, I think everyone needs and deserves to be heard. So the first thing that I do is listen, because what they're going through is a painful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, as you said, a very stressful experience. It affects how they eat, how they sleep. It affects the quality of their relationships with their spouse, with their children, with their coworkers and their boss as well. So again, the unhappiness at work, and you talked a little bit ago about people who are engaged, and the 70% who are disengaged. Well, you know, there's a passively disengaged which are people that are sort of just sleepwalking through the day. And then of that disengaged group, there's a subset of those who are aggressively and actively disengaged, and they are your worst case scenario because they are the poison that are gossiping in the lunchroom and complaining about everything and getting other people riled up and spreading the negativity throughout the workforce. So those are, you know, people who clearly have a voice, but need to be engaged and brought in so that they feel that they are aware of what their company is doing. They're part of the process. They're making a difference. Their contribution is valued and valuable. But I think the first thing that everybody really, one of our core needs as human beings is to feel seen and heard. So that's right. Where I generally start with somebody is okay. To let them share their experience. And then, you know, we look at so much of this is out of our control. So much of this is the culture and where you may be stuck in. But really, let's start with where we do have some control.
Right.
And what are some of those small shifts we can make internally that can at least start setting things in motion? Because when you shift one thing, everything else by nature just has to shift a little bit. So we will start focusing on some of the things that they can bring to the table that are different. You know, if they are actively or passively disengaged, then you know, let's get real. And how are you contributing to the problem versus the solution? Because mm-hmm. if you're part of the problem, you can't be the solution. So having them, you know, giving them a mirror to what they're bringing to the office in terms of their energy, in terms of are they showing up and doing their best every day, or are they phoning it in and getting annoyed or hurt when they're not recognized for their contribution? You know, there is a give and take there. And then we'll start looking at, you know, other areas like what is the reality of their financial situation? Is it time to be changing jobs? Is it time to start working on that resume? And what are the things that they really are passionate about that they want to start marketing? Or how can they bring some other fulfilling elements into their life? You talked about burnout. We talked about a little bit, you know, it was certainly in the energy project article about we're glued to our BlackBerries and our cell phones, and it's constant. It's the first thing we do when we get up in the morning. It's the last thing we do when we go to bed at night. Well, where is there room for self-care? For focusing a little bit on something that feeds you rather than depletes you? And we're not talking about fast food and
right.
dessert, but something that feeds you rather than deplete you. Maybe it is being, you know, active in your community. Maybe it is, you know, donating time to a children's project, to your own children. Maybe it's gardening. Maybe it's meditating. But let's start finding some of those things that bring you pleasure and sustain you and your spirit. And then let's see how those things start to shift and develop and how we want to bring more and more into them. Maybe there's a career change in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different avenues to take, but I do believe in it starts with looking at yourself.
Right.
What you need, what you're not getting, what you're bringing to the table that maybe needs to shift.
So does that mean then, Joy, and by the way, if anyone is listening to us live today, Monday, June 2nd, at 5:30 p.m., 533. The call-in number to ask Joy a question is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Does that mean, Joy, when you mentioned, because we talk about burnout, as in this article, for instance, they reference within the article an accounting firm that they worked with, the company. What was the name of the company again that you that we mentioned at the beginning of the Schwartz?
Albemarle?
No, the company that
Albemarle?
No, I don't remember. Evergreen, or the name of the company that Schwartz heads up, Tony Schwartz.
Oh, the Energy Project.
The Energy Project, thank you. The Energy Project was working with an accounting firm, and the accounting firm, you know, during tax season, that's the perfect time in a big city to get burnout. They say, we're judging you, all of you accountants, by the hours you put in, even if it's sort of... They said, what else are we going to do? We have to judge by their productivity, and the productivity is how much they're burning the candle at both ends, mm-hmm. period. And the company said, you know what? But we can change that model, and we'll have every 90 minutes. You take a 15-minute break, and you leave early when you're done, and all kinds of different, as a control group. They had one group of accountants that can breathe, mm-hmm. and that they treated them like they were more important than just banging out returns. And
well, they were evaluated on a different metric.
And that metric turned out, at least the evaluation was, that they did better. So, but it was like it took the company to go, whoa, who would have expected it? And it comes down to trust, because usually the employer, the company, is saying, well, I got to trust these knuckleheads. If we give them time off, they won't be, you know, no one's going to be cracking the whip, so they won't do it. But again, it's almost paradoxically, they were more productive as a result of giving them what they need in this balance. But when you mentioned, I thought it was fascinating, and I'm wondering, is some of the burnout potentially self-induced? So, therefore, before you get involved with how bad your company is, and because the person comes to you, this aggressive disengager comes and says, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. They don't even appreciate me because they're all fucking stupid. They're incompetent. My boss is incompetent. And then I'm between a rock and a hard place. If you could meet these people, Joy, you would know what I'm talking
mm-hmm,
about.
Mm-hmm.
So as part of the, and I never thought of it this way, it may be true, but do you then turn the mirror on them and say, but wait a minute, first, before we get involved with how many 70 hours a week that you must work, how are you contributing to your own burnout? Is that really fair to say that that's
I think it is
point?
Fair to say. And listen, there certainly, you know, there are companies that are working their employees into the ground. I mean, that is true. And things need to shift all the way around. But, you know, I think it's pretty well understood that what we focus on grows. If you're spending your whole day focused on what is wrong, what you hate, then you're going to feel the energy of wrong and hate all the time. And that's an exhausting energy. That is something that doesn't make you inspired
right.
to go do your best work. And it doesn't lift you up so that you go home and you're energized to be with your family. It burns you out just as much as anything else.
And what is it that's burning you out? What is that? What's burning? What's doing the eating it up? Eating up your
that
liver?
That focus on the negativity and everything that's wrong. That continuing to fuel your own self with the negative energy. And
it's disempowering.
It
and
is
it's
disempowering.
Victimizing. So it's always look what they're doing to me.
To me, exactly.
Well, what about if it's true?
You know, it often probably is. And we're all also responsible for ourselves and what we bring to the table. So as I said a little bit ago, when one thing shifts, everything has to shift a little bit. So what if that person who, you know, shows up miserable each day and fights with the boss and just does what he needs to do to get through the day because it's so stressful, what if he or she did something to practice self-care in the morning before they went to work? Maybe it is taking 5 minutes to count the things that they're grateful for in their life. Maybe it is taking their dog for a walk mm-hmm. and getting some fresh air outside. Maybe it's pouring a big glass of orange juice and just looking at that bright color and being like, saying, oh, this is delicious and fresh and it's a good way to start my day. It can be any small thing. But when you start carrying positives and you start looking for what you can be grateful for in the day, in the life, maybe it's that you have a good friend sitting next to you as your coworker, and you're grateful for that. Maybe it's that you do have a job. Maybe, you know, you've had a sick child or yourself, and you have insurance benefits, and that's a blessing to be grateful for. And when you start to focus on things that are positive,
mm-hmm.
then you naturally start to shift your behavior and your attitude and what you're then able to contribute to that workplace. And the same way we talked a minute ago, about active disengagement and the poison that they can spread, well, the actively engaged employees can spread a whole different kind of energy, and they can help engage their coworkers mm-hmm. as well and lift everybody up.
That's actually quite meaningful because it's sort of like then the idea, which I think people may be resistant toward, as you manage your own states. So, you know, if you come in, you're even the shift can be seismic, I suppose. You know, we underestimate what one person can do, that because people do respond to our level of consciousness or unconsciousness, even unconsciously, right?
Mm-hmm.
People respond to it. So I suppose if you're able to, whether it's contemplating the orange juice or in some other way being identified with, you know, the real you and not getting caught up in your shitty life story about how poor me, where you come in with that and the, you know, and sort of your supervisor might pick up on that and just kind of beat you up more because you're beating yourself up and you're in that negative energy. If you come in a different energy, it might have a profound effect where you're starting from within. I mean, is that, because it might be a little bit counterintuitive to people to hear. Again, it's not me. I'm coming to see you for you to tell me what I should do, and it's not to tell me how I should change. I'm miserable because of them, right?
Sure.
So we're back to, though, you know, the idea first, you know, look in the mirror and see why this may be, why you're having this reaction. In fact, that's probably really the long and the short of it, ultimately, right? It's
absolutely. And listen, we cannot expect our jobs to be all things to us. Our employers can't expect us to be all things and on all the time for them,
right?
Is one of the places that we started this conversation. We also can't expect our jobs to be all things to us. We can't expect our jobs to be, you know, always the emotional fulfillment, the physical fulfillment, and all the other core, to fulfill all of the core needs. We do have to take some of that on ourselves. If we're going home every night and kicking the dog, that's not the dog's fault.
Right.
It's what we're bringing to the situation. So if we shift and start practicing some self-care and putting some focus on things that are positive that we can be grateful for, then we will show up in a different energy and we will do better work.
And why is that gratitude so important?
Well, why is gratitude important to you?
Well, again, I don't know that. That's why I'm saying I know that it's, why is it important to me? I think that when one is grateful, one attracts more things to be grateful for, but, you know, it just seems to kind of happen.
Absolutely. And it immediately pulls you out of the victim mentality.
Yeah.
It's no longer, oh no, why me? I have gotten the short end of the stick. It is now a fullness of, look at all that I have. I am blessed.
Right. Even when, one can say this even sitting in a little jail cell with bars on the window because you're sitting there breathing. And I suppose if you come from that, if you're actually someone who could do that and say, you know, I'm breathing, there's a little tiny little plant across the way in my cell, what's wrong with this moment? Again, I struggle with that because I think all of us need to do that. If I came to see you, I'll tell you what I sometimes go through, and I think people may relate to this. There are times I'm listening or I meditate or I'm listening to my Eckhart Tolle tapes and I'm totally feeling that connectedness, which is the sort of the oneness that is actually quite peaceful. And there is a space around everything and I'm in that kind of place of you know, sort of oneness. I feel connected to, like, source energy. I'm really creative and I feel about as good as, you know, almost that this is all that it could be about. And then I kind of turn around and I kind of go like this and I log on to my email. And it doesn't take long for that vortex to suck me right in to that. It could take 3 seconds where I forget.
Take one Visa bill.
Yeah.
Right, one Visa bill or one email. And it's everything that I just worked on and everything I'm grateful for was just like, this motherfucker. I'm just like, I'm looking at it and go, wait a minute, how am I supposed to? It's not easy. So the idea to continually bring with you the, and I don't know whether this is just one component of it, but the gratitude, and I know it's hard for all of us because what happens when you're tested?
Right.
It's easy when you're sitting on vacation and you have plenty of money and plenty of health and you feel like we all do, all the building blocks, the pieces, everything, I've arrived, everything
sure.
is here, even though it won't last long one way or another. But that sense of, you know what, this is, you know, life's good. So then when life's not good,
yeah.
Or you're saying, life is good, I love my children, I have a great relationship, I have even a good job, but there's something on the horizon that makes me very anxious. And again, I think that part of the burnout, perhaps, is, why do I hate my job? Is because maybe I expect too much from this freaking place, too, right? I mean, whatever it is, though, I come to you and I say, I'm coming to you, heal me, right? A lot of people come to a coach
mm-hmm.
or a shrink, and you're the one who is, I'm elevating you. Is it you? What tools have you got to make me feel great? So I've already maybe messed the whole thing up because I expect from you to make me different and feel differently, and I don't want to have burnout anymore. So how do you not take on all of that in the hour that I'm going to see you? You say to me again, look in the mirror, and I'm going to say, I'm looking in the freaking mirror. I didn't pay you to tell me that it's my fault that my job sucks or that I'm feeling this way. So is there, being you're not, and I'm just questioning about what one does when it's not sort of someone who's sitting on a couch and you're just encouraging them to extemporize and to free associate, you're being practical, right? And they're maybe taking notes. So how do you know when you've reached someone? I mean, when do you feel this connection? And how do people, what will they take away from you? And this isn't about you per se, but I mean, how do we get to that point where, again, the burnout without the company making the changes can be changed, even if from within, when you don't actually send out any resumes. Before you send out the resume, you better send out the resumes in a different state of mind.
Right? Absolutely. You better show up at the interview in a different state of mind, because if you are feeling negative or desperate, they will smell it.
They'll smell it. So even if you come to the interview, you're going to say, are you kidding me? I'm not stupid. I'm going to be all smiles and be in my Sunday best, but they'll sense that you're feigning it, right?
You know, Sean Achor, I think is his, A-C-H-O-R, I think that's how you pronounce it. He taught the most popular course at Harvard, and it was How to Be Happy.
Mm.
And it was by far, for the last 8 years or something.
Undergraduate course, I guess it's all
undergrad, whatever it is, it was the most popular course at Harvard.
Sure.
And what they talked about, and what he teaches, and he has researched through Harvard, there are skills. Yes, you are born with a certain level of happiness. And this is only because if life is a choice, your life today is a series of choices that you made yesterday. And so if you are not happy with today, you need to make different choices. Jack Canfield says the first thing you need to do is take 100% responsibility for your life. Then you have the opportunity to make different choices because you take
responsibility. So what does that mean? Break that down.
Well, 100%. I want to go back to, I just want to, the Sean Achor thing is, you're born with a certain level of happiness. Some people are moderately happy, is their natural state. Some people are just through the roof happy all the time. And then there are the clinically depressed, and some of that is what you're born with. But everyone can learn skills that make you more happy. And there's all the research, you know, that supports this. And the number one thing is take a moment and find something to be grateful for, because the physiological shift that happens within you has to change. It's when you start thinking about your dog, your daughter, your mother, you know, your money, whatever it is. It causes
a cascade of bullshit.
It causes a shift within you. And then when you begin to look and say, what are the choices that I can make that keep me on this path of feeling happy? And that's where you can take back some control, because when you're in that victim mode,
sure,
look what they're doing to me, it's impossible to do anything. So you're in that spiral down. And it's about making the choice to spiral.
So it's a choice.
Yeah. Life is a choice. I mean, and again, if you have money today, you made some good choices yesterday. If you have no money today, you made some not so good choices, or things happened that have caused you to now shift. Okay.
But the money part always seems to make a false paradigm, because, you know, what
money? Well, I could say I look at my own life. And I got to a point where I said, "What the path I'm on is not sustainable." And I had to look at the choices I was making today. And I was trying to sustain unsustainable debt. And I had to finally come to the point where I looked at that. I could have some control over that.
Right.
And that starts the cascade, change and shift. So that today I am in a very different position. I look at money very differently. I make very different choices. And I do not have nearly the stress that I once did, because I took control of it. Now, at the same time, I was also in a work environment that was profoundly negative. It was awful. It was depleting. It was hostile.
Well, because of you. You could have changed that, Joyce said.
Okay, but that's exactly what I'm getting to. It was, look how they treat me. Look what they're doing to me. Look how they treat me. And I would go in there ready to attack, defend, point my finger. And the day I made a different choice and I chose to say, okay, what can I do differently? If I'm part of the problem, I have to come in and say good morning. Because before, there was nobody was speaking. It was just awful. And in one day, I all of a sudden came into work totally different. And people who did not speak to me within days began speaking to me.
Well, was
simply
that,
because of my choice.
Well, but is that a little like neuro-linguistic programming or the sense of, like we talked about or at the, you know, Tony Robbins talks about, that if you people said, how you doing? You say, I'm outstanding, whether you kind of mean it or not. But by doing it, number one, by doing it and saying it,
it
changes you. But then also people will respond to you a lot more vigorously than they would if you're just like
exactly.
a morose,
But if you're in that cycle
slug.
Of look what they're doing to me, look how they treat me, they should be more respectful, they should be including me, they should value me.
Well, how'd that turn out? And what changed?
I changed.
They never really changed, right?
Well, they... The environment changed for me.
Right.
Because
explain that. See, the environment changed for you, even though they were still the same miserable assholes they were. Okay, so.
Because really, we're talking about your experience of the workplace. The workplace and the culture, you know, hopefully some of these models we talked about earlier, Google and Deutsche, hopefully they're setting a good example and the corporate community and the corporate cultures will start to change. But in the meantime, it's our own individual experiences of work that are what's burning people out. And sometimes it's the workload, and sometimes it's the stress of finances, and sometimes it's the negative boss. But if we can change the way we experience work in terms of how we show up each day, it can only help.
Okay.
It may not solve everything,
okay.
but it certainly can help.
So I guess what I'm just, if you show up at work and you are conscious, and I use that in the spiritual term, not just, you know, as a mm-hmm. medical, right? But you're conscious and aware, and you can see what your own patterns are and then what patterns of people around you. Therefore, you don't get sucked into, perhaps, let's just say you are in a really dysfunctional environment at work, which is not that unusual in our fast-paced world. So you're working in Manhattan. There's a lot of unconsciousness. There's a lot of, you know, driven, greed-based behavior and a lot of hierarchical, non-consensual power-type behavior. Now, it's driving you mad, giving you an ulcer. But you can't immediately quit. But you start changing and you start taking a look at how you contribute to it, and also when you start to feel whatever, panic, anxiety, you just see it happening, so you don't have to necessarily get totally become one with it. You could have a little space around it, like, mm-hmm. well, that's not, you know, you look at it instead of become it. You see it, right? That, if you could keep that up long enough and you're in that place, either people around you will change, or you may actually leave them. Then you may actually leave if it's untenable when you're conscious. In other words, when you change, if you were saying good morning every day and trying and trying, and every day people are like, yeah, what's so fucking good about it every day, you might eventually simply find yourself leaving, whether and money might be secondary because you just can't.
I can only speak,
which is what happened,
truly for my own experience.
Yes.
And, you know, as a coach with other clients and stuff, but in my own experience, mm-hmm. when I got out of that downward spiral and I began to change, it wasn't overnight, mm-hmm. although there were some immediate shifts, but all of a sudden, solutions started showing up for different issues.
Maybe opportunities for other jobs.
Exactly.
Why would they show up?
Because when one thing shifts, everything has to shift. It's just the law of the universe. So, you know, we talked about gratitude is one tool, and it's an important tool. The mirror we talked about earlier is another important tool. It's really important for people to understand also, one of the first things I discuss with my clients is, you are not your job.
Right.
You know, we ask somebody, so tell me about you, and the first thing they say is, I'm an accountant, or
right.
I'm a lawyer, or, you know, and we've gotten this...
Or I'm
into
unemployed.
This program, or I'm unemployed. And we're programmed to label ourselves with our occupation or our job. We're so much more than that.
Well, yeah.
So understanding and giving someone the space to just sit in that understanding that they are not their job. So that toxic environment is not who they are, and giving them a space to really start to explore who they are. What are their talents? What are their skills? What are they passionate about? What inspires them? What gets them really jazzed? Mm-hmm. And then let's start building a path to bring more of that into your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's also, you know, I'm glad you said that, because it's also, too, about what we expect. This is what they, in poverty research, the challenge why so few people actually break out. It's not impossible, but the few people that are able to break out of it had somebody somewhere, they had a sense of possibility. And there was just research, and I don't know if I sent it to you today or yesterday, but poverty can lower your IQ by 13 points.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
I know it from working with Save the Children. It's a severe issue. There's less cognitive skills, just less language skills.
Yes, yes, yes. And so that's what ends up happening. And I notice this with a lot of people who call a client. You know, they have a job making $35,000, and this is a good job to them. The possibility that they could be making 65 never really enters, it's not even a fantasy, because they keep thinking about the how and the how can I possibly do that. And that's the other aspect that you maybe could speak about. Like, how do you get somebody to think about other possibilities?
Well, I mean, that's certainly something we've talked about that is a challenge for women. And even, you know, Sheryl Sandberg wrote about, it's one of the challenges for women is that we set limits for ourselves without even realizing we're doing it. So many women would never even imagine the possibility of being a CEO because, well, I'm going to have kids. So I'm not going to, you know, try to be the top in my class, you know, when you're entering the workforce, or I'm not really going to go for that promotion because I'm probably going to have to quit in a couple of years anyway. So we set limits for ourselves. And certainly if you've never been exposed to possibilities of something greater outside of your family or your community, that you don't even know it's there. You know, one of the benefits, I believe, of technology now is that we do have exposure to so many different things. Whether you are, you know, in rural Arkansas, you can go online and you can read about any place in the world, about any company in the world. You can have access to any fashion or celebrity in the world. So there is more opportunity for exposure than ever before. But we do need mentors and people to encourage us to dream
That's
bigger.
That's great. So we have about 10 seconds left. Joy, can we have is there a LinkedIn or a website that we can give for you?
Sure, absolutely. You can visit joy@taketheleadccg.com is my email address. You can visit www.taketheleadccg.com for the website.
Outstanding. Thank you. This has been
a terrific show.
I feel uplifted myself.
Really?
You know, the problem I was talking to you about, that I feel a little bit better. It's inspiring when you're gripped by anxiety to try to, if I took away one thing, it was to focus on what we're grateful about. I have many things to be grateful about, but I haven't really thought about it much in the last few days.
Yes.
So thank you, Joy. Thank you, Deborah. And we'll see you next week on Women's Rights in the Workplace with Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell. Have a strong and powerful week. Thank you, Joy, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye to our listeners now. See ya.